From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One of the many people hitting the road for the holiday weekend is my guest Robert Sullivan. His trip will probably be longer than yours. With his wife and two children, he's traveling cross-country for about the 30th time. He's written a new memoir about his 90,000-some-odd miles on the road and the rest stops, bad motels, and near accidents along the way. We'll talk with him and ask his two children about their backseat adventures. Also, Alberto Gonzalez and his rise to power in the Bush administration. We'll talk with Bill Minutaglio, a Texas journalist whose new book follows the career of the Attorney General. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the rhetoric of TV pundits who have turned political vilification into a form of entertainment. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Parents in the front seat, two kids in the back, and a trunk filled with stuff. Like a lot of people, my guest Robert Sullivan is taking a long car trip over the holiday. Longer than most, he's traveling cross-country by car with his wife and two children. He lives in New York, but he has family on both coasts, which is one reason why he's traveled cross-country by car about 30 times. Now he's written a new memoir called Cross Country. It's got a long but great subtitle, 15 years and 90,000 miles on the roads and interstates of America with Lewis and Clark, a lot of bad motels, a moving van, Emily Post, Jack Kerouac, my wife, my mother-in-law, two kids, and enough coffee to kill an elephant. Sullivan has joined us several times on the show, most recently to discuss his book, Rats. Let's start with a reading from Cross Country, and then we'll ask his two children about life in the back seat.
We're packed in. The kids in the back, the parents in front, our stuff filling the trunk piled up around our knees. In our hearts, we're excited. We're excited in the part of our hearts that knows 3,000 miles is doable. A snap, 3 or 4, or, longest case scenario, 5 days, which is about as much time as we have. Like many Americans, we have stuff to do, stuff to deal with, and about as much time as we can stand. In our hearts, we're also weary. We're weary in the part that's done this before, that knows that 3,000 miles is a long, long way, that has been out late at night on a dark road when our eyes have been trying to stay awake, and our eyes only wish, like all the rest of our tired bodies, that they were not driving anymore.
Well, Robert Sullivan, how many times do you think you've traveled cross-country by car?
Traveled for 15 years, more than 2 times a year, so a couple of dozen times. One time we did 5 round trips in a year.
No.
Yep.
Why have you been traveling cross-country by car so much over the years?
Basically, it started out having to do with the fact that I was dating somebody who lived in Oregon, and I was from Oregon, and I was from and lived in New York. And then it went from dating someone who lives in Oregon to marrying that person from Oregon, and then to having grandparents on the East Coast and the West Coast, and having to go back and forth to see those grandparents with the grandchildren. And frankly, I'm a writer. I mean, you know, I can't make tickets early for planes. And so if either you go at the last minute and pay $18 million or you drive. And up to about this year, it's still been economical to drive. But I fear that this is, well, I always think that the year we do it is the last year we're going to do it. But we'll see.
There's one passage in your book where you're packing up the car, you're getting ready for another cross-country trip, and you say to yourself, why do we do this to our kids? What do you think you put your kids through when you have to do a 3,000-mile cross-country car trip?
Well, of course, I don't know what I put them through because, as anybody can tell you, especially them, I am not them. But, you know, when sometimes kids get these puzzles when they're little, a little United States puzzle where you try to remember where to put the states and so forth. I remember that when my son was very young, he could do that very early on. So I think we put him through a lot, and we're always saying, oh my gosh, we shouldn't drive. On the other hand, when we did fly very recently, one time we flew, I felt, and I think at some point all of us felt as if we were cheated somehow. We've gone through a lot. There's a lot of, you know, everybody hold on. It's one more day. We'll just eat some cheese and crackers in the gas station. But on the other hand, we've stopped in these amazing little state parks. And at some point, maybe after they grow up despising us for driving them so so much, at some point, our hope is, I think I can speak for my wife in this one moment, our hope is that they'll say, I remember a waterfall, or I remember a really nice guy in that rest stop, or I remember those people who, they weren't in any rooms, but they let us stay.
Well, Robert, while we have this nice conversation, as we speak, your wife is preparing for a family trip cross-country tomorrow. It will be you, your wife, and your two children. And your two children happen to be in the studio with you, your daughter Louise, who is 10, your son Sam, who is 15. And Sam and Louise, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about your experiences of cross-country travel. Are you looking forward to or dreading this big trip tomorrow?
I'm looking forward to it, but I'm kind of also dreading it, so, yeah.
And Sam?
Same answer. I would be probably okay with flying, a little bit okay with it.
Robert, did you hear that?
Yes, I did. Yes.
So what do you both do, Sam, Louise, what do you both do to keep yourself, busy during this really long car drive?
Well, I have a lot of books that I read, and of course my mom tells me that I don't have enough, but I read most of the time, and also a lot of sleeping. We do a lot of sleeping, but sometimes we miss all the sights, but yeah, and a lot of being annoying to one's brother or sister, so yeah.
Sam, what do you do to keep busy?
Well, in the past, my sister and mother are really, really productive in the car. They like craft stuff, and I've never really been able to do that. So either I read, or I But now this trip, I get to take musical instruments in the car with me. So I guess I'll just be practicing my fretted stringed instruments nonstop, and driving my sister insane.
Do you as a family ever revert to singing songs together on the road to keep occupied and entertained?
Oftentimes, yes.
Yeah.
What are the songs of preference?
Trad.
Yes, trad or folk or something like that.
They're hardcore trad, or as it's sometimes said, trad is it's rad.
Trad is rad.
But I didn't know what trad meant until this year. So
what does it mean?
Well, it's an abbreviation for traditional. So. Yeah,
so are you doing traditional folk music or traditional jazz?
Mostly traditional, both, but mostly traditional folk. I mean, yeah.
It's hard. There's a lot of trad.
Yeah, so much trad.
Should I ask for a rousing version of a car favorite, of a cross country car favorite?
That'd be if it's okay. All right. Can we do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like that.
I mean, Carrie, is it okay?
Please.
Okay. How's this? Okay. Here we go.
Do you actually have a guitar with you?
Yes, we have all our instruments. Well, not all of them, but...
Did you know it's National Accordion Awareness Month?
Dad just got an accordion that he's very excited about, so...
This is going to be like a traveling family act. Who knew?
We're kind of like... We look a lot like the Von Trapp family.
Yeah.
Except it's like Homer Simpson instead of Christopher Plummer. Although I'm not quite as good looking as Homer Simpson. Okay, wait on. One.
Wow, who knew you'd sound so good?
I was
thinking
you.
More of my family. You guys are good.
You're nice to say so. But,
no, you must actually have fun doing this in the car together.
I do. I'm sure that'll be another thing that they'll bring up in court against me around people when the restraining order is put out. So.
So just to clarify, I should explain. You're in a studio in New York. I'm in a studio in Philadelphia, so I'm not seeing you. So, Robert, that's you on accordion, and Sam, you on guitar, and obviously, Louise, that's you singing. You have a really beautiful voice.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, Robert, I can only hope that when you're playing accordion, your wife is driving?
But when I'm playing accordion, of course, I'm driving her. Well, I don't have to finish the sentence, I'm sure you know, it is a button accordion, which of course is a big distinction among accordion players. Not that I could be, you know, technically considered an accordion player, given the way I play accordion.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Robert Sullivan and his son Sam Sullivan and daughter Louise Sullivan. And Robert has written a new book called Cross Country, 15 Years and 9,000 Miles on the Road. And it's about traveling cross country back and forth many times with his family by car. When you're traveling as a family by car, I mean, I think one of the big issues is who gets to decide when you stop for the rest stop, you know, and... Is this a matter of dispute when you're all traveling together, whether it's time for a bathroom stop yet or not?
I think that most of it, like, if we're all hungry, we need to stop at a rest stop because they have lots of food. Well, not really food, but stuff that you can't eat. But also it's because you need to go to the bathroom, so... I think that's mostly when, like, my mom needs to go to the bathroom or needs food because she's kind of like the head. And so we all follow her. So, yeah, I think that's when we stop.
You know, as the non-head, I think the parents are always confused because, you know, on the cross-country car trips, because they're saying, okay, now we're... You know, we're going to stop for the rest. Here comes the rest stop, or let's stop for the rest stop. Okay, we stop for the rest stop, and then we're trying to move. The parent sees it as, okay, we're trying to keep going, but now there's a call to use the rest stop. But we just stopped. I thought we just stopped at the rest. So that's kind of the paradigm yes?
I think that maybe after having driven cross country all these times, sort of like impeccable bladder control has been eaten into me.
Yeah, it's true. Sam has almost never stopped going cross country. It's pretty amazing. So
maybe able to shut down all body functions completely.
But he's also a teenager, so that's another thing. Yeah, that's part of the
Now, what kinds of like devices do you travel with to keep busy? Do you have like iPods? Do you listen to the radio? What do you do to keep yourselves plugged in?
I used to have an iPod, but I can't really focus on an iPod. I need a CD player because I switch from song to song. You know, I can only listen to 30 seconds of a song now. I officially have no attention span anymore.
Oh, hey, that's great.
No, but CD players let me listen to the entire, you know, really appreciate the entire, you know, not just a single. Although it's sort of cool that with iTunes, it's sort of brought back the single. You know, now singles are being released again. It's pretty cool.
I do not have an iPod, and I do have a CD player, like a Walkman. But mostly, everyone picks out like 25 CDs, and then we have 100 CDs to go through cross country, so we each get to pick. But that's kind of a problem because most everyone wants their CD to play because that's one they like a lot.
Well, Sam and Louise, I'm going to let you leave the studio and move around and stuff while I talk to your father a little bit more. But listen, I really appreciate you talking with us, and I appreciate you playing for us. I mean, I really had no idea. So thanks a lot, and have a great trip.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye, and thank you.
Bye.
Okay, and we'll talk more with Robert Sullivan about his new book, Cross Country, about driving cross country by car time and time again with his family. That's after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Sullivan. His new book, Cross Country, is a memoir about traveling cross country by car, which he's done about 30 times. When I spoke with him yesterday, his family was preparing to leave today for yet another cross country road trip. I asked him what he's driving.
As a concession to the troops, we're going in a minivan. I've only done that once before. If it was just me making the decision, we wouldn't be in a minivan for several reasons, one of which I think it's going to cost more. But the other is that everybody, if you're in the back seat, I can't talk to you. I can't bore you with historical details of the trip. And now you could see why I would, and how could I do this to these people? Why would you want to be with me? But we can't talk. We can't talk at all. But, you know, but I think we'll do some seat shifting of time to time. We'll see. I'm sure, you know, I have a feeling that this is the year there'll be a headline in the newspaper about, you know, the car found abandoned on the side of the road and just the father in it. And first, you know, people might be worried about the kids, but then they'll realize, oh, no, the kids were smart. They got out of there. And so they left him. And yeah.
You know, one of the things that you've done in your book is alternate between your story of being on the road and more historical stories. So you tell the story of like the Lewis and Clark expedition as you're traveling through the Pacific Northwest, and you write about like the history of roadside motels, and you write about Jack Kerouac and his version of being on the road. Has it made your trips any more interesting to have all these kind of literary and historical companions as you were traveling?
Well, I have this kind of disease where, you know, I want to know why everything is the way it is. Recently, we found out that the song "Don't Fence Me In" by Cole Porter was actually co-written by a Montana, as I understand it, a Montana state highway official, maybe an engineer, I'm not sure, who is the guy who also wrote the Montana historical roadside plaques, which I always thought were quite good plaques, quite well written. And so he co-wrote that song with Cole Porter, didn't get credit at first. Supposedly Porter wanted to give him credit. I don't know. But so I just feel like there's so much, I have way too much excitement about, you know, stuff that's interesting along the road in terms of history. But I guess lately I've been thinking about how the road itself is this American public space, this public space everywhere. The road is, as that landscape historian J.B. Jackson, this genius writer, says, the road is the first public space.
What's your favorite kind of place to stop for breakfast?
Oh, I'm remembering a place right off the interstate in Idaho, in northern Idaho, I think near Kellogg, in kind of an old mining area. But there's a place, it's a diner on the side of the road, and we had pan-fried trout and scrambled eggs and pancakes, and it was really local, even though it was, you know, kind of where a fast food restaurant would have been. But that's really, I feel like pancakes is the really national food that always can have this local variation. I remember we had wild huckleberries in the pancakes once in the morning in Butte, Montana, and there was an old timer who was running this kind of drugstore that served breakfast. And I remember Charles Kuralt had been in there, you know, one of the great road chroniclers. And breakfast is the great road meal. I mean, forget dinner, forget lunch. I mean, you know, you have to do those things once in a while. But breakfast, the great road breakfast, and then you're ready to go. But my favorite kind is you know, a pancake with something that reflects the localness of the place.
Well, have a really good trip.
Well, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Sullivan's new book is called Cross Country. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please. Don't fence me in. Don't fence me in. Just turn me loose. Let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western sky.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with journalist Bill Minutaglio about his new book chronicling the career of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the rise of political vilification as a form of popular entertainment. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his new biography of Alberto Gonzalez, called The President's Counselor, Bill Minutaglio writes that Gonzalez has crafted and processed the most secretive and controversial directives in modern U.S. history, but he has somehow managed to remain the most hidden member of the Bush family's inner circle. Gonzalez's career has been closely linked to George W. Bush since Bush's gubernatorial campaign. Under Governor Bush, Gonzalez was legal counsel, Secretary of State, and was appointed to the Texas Supreme Court. When President Bush went to the White House, Gonzalez moved to Washington to become White House counsel, and last year he became the first Hispanic to serve as Attorney General. Before writing a book about Gonzalez, Minutaglio wrote the book First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. Minutaglio was a reporter for the Dallas Morning News from 1983 to 2001. President Bush first got to know Alberto Gonzalez when Gonzalez was working at a law firm in Houston called Vinson and Elkins. And this is a big firm that represented Enron, Halliburton, and Brown and Root. What kind of work was Gonzalez doing there?
You know, they used to call Vinson and Elkins Vinson and Enron, you know, pejoratively nicknamed V&E, Vinson and Enron. The Elkins was subbed out and Enron was put in. He did a little bit of everything. He was in an area of the law firm. It was one of these mega firms where there were hundreds of attorneys, primarily based in Houston, but another important political and kind of economic capitals around the country and even overseas. He did. He was assigned to a group called the Transactions Team, and he was a transactions lawyer. And he basically drew up contracts and negotiated real estate deals, petrochemical deals, very, very high-end bits of business involving some of those companies you just mentioned.
And how did he start to work with George W. Bush and Karl Rove?
In Houston, you know, it's America's fourth largest city, but in some ways it's a small town. Everybody knows everybody at a certain level above the cloud line. And as you ascend in prominence at a place like V&E, Vinson and Elkins, and then dip your toe into political circles, as Gonzalez was showing some interest in the late 80s and early 90s, his name just sort of gusted forward. And quite frankly, there was a concerted effort by Karl Rove and George W. Bush and even the elder George Bush to identify suitable minority figures whom they could draw into the Republican Party and you know, use in some dimension, politically speaking, to advance their agenda in Texas and even nationally. And that's how Gonzalez came on the radar. His first encounter with the Bush family was with the elder George Bush, when the elder George Bush spoke to colleagues and friends in Houston and literally said, do you know of any good prominent Latinos who might make members of my administration, my presidential administration in the late 80s and early 90s? And Gonzalez was offered some positions by the elder George Bush to come to Washington, but turned them down, and but remained on the radar. And his son later on identified or remembered Alberto Gonzalez.
You make it sound in your book as if the relationship between George W. Bush and Alberto Gonzalez got started as a result of Karl Rove's feelings that in order for George W. Bush to rise to power, he needed more support among evangelicals and Hispanics.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was carefully deliberated and orchestrated and talked about that beginning here in Texas and then later on nationally, the Republicans would want to steal the middle ground, so to speak, as they called it, and then cater to Latino voters by arguing that they had a socially conservative agenda that might actually be appealing to a greater majority or a greater number of Latino voters than maybe some Republican strategists had previously assumed. And again, Alberto Gonzalez just seemed like a perfect person to kind of put that agenda on his back and push him forward. He, you know, admittedly was a very, very reluctant participant in some of this early on. I think he was intrigued by the proximity to power and the entreaties, the visits from the Bush family, but he's not, and I think to this day remains a distinctly almost non-public public figure, if that makes sense.
Let's go through the positions that Alberto Gonzalez held in Governor Bush's administration, starting with general counsel to the governor. What's one of the more interesting things you think he did in that role that have shaped your impression of him?
In Gonzalez's tenure as counsel to then Governor Bush, he produced or oversaw clemency recommendations in 57 death penalty cases. In other words, he was processing and looking at paperwork for 57 death row inmates. All of those were basically sent to Bush with a sense that these executions should go forward. There wasn't one of the 57 in which Gonzalez stated that, I think we should pause, I think we should grant a 30-day reprieve and review and almost challenge whether or not this execution should go forward. I found that extremely profound. And one thing that I came across in my research that I hadn't been aware of before, I'm not sure that too many other people had known about, was the fact that Gonzalez had attended an execution in Texas, and I think was able to witness firsthand the complexity, the wide array of emotions that go into an execution here. And for some reason, I think as a biographer and a historian, I was looking for some of that emotional quotient and for lack of a better word, almost a poetic, deeper sense in his memos to Bush about the death penalty. And I thought that would speak to just the challenges that go into deciding whether someone should live and die and whether you're recommending to the governor that you stay in execution at least for 30 days. And I didn't see that there as much as I think just personally I would have hoped for.
Tell us something about what Gonzalez did as Secretary of State in Texas that helped shape your impression of him.
Sure. Yeah. As Secretary of State in Texas, Gonzalez, I think it was a politicizing period in his life. It was a moment when he had to begin going out in public. As Governor Bush's counsel, he did a lot of his work, you know, in-house, behind closed doors, sometimes in courtrooms, and just sort of out of sight, off the radar or below the radar. As Secretary of State, he was forced for the first time really in his life to go out and grip and grin and, you know, pose with babies and take pictures and this and that and do a lot of politics. And I think he understood at that point in his life that he was off on a whole different tangent. If he had ever had any inclinations in his life to view the law and the practice of law as sort of a higher, almost artistic kind of calling, I think a lot of that began slipping away a little bit when he had to go out as Secretary of State in Texas. It's a kind of a showcase job in the sense that you go out, not a lot of wielding of power, but you almost raise the profile of the governor by being his roving ambassador and try to drum up votes. And as well, you know, frankly, a lot of his utility within the Bush network and the Bush family, the Bush dynasty at that point was coming to fruition. He was out as Secretary of State in a unique position, according to Karl Rove and George W. Bush, to draw more Latino voters to the Republican Party.
President Bush appointed Alberto Gonzalez to the Texas State Supreme Court. Was that a controversial appointment?
It was controversial in the sense that he wasn't seen as an arching, you know, legal visionary. His appointment to the Texas Supreme Court was challenged by some folks who had wished that Bush had picked someone who was a great legal mind and was a great legal scholar. And Gonzalez just simply didn't have that reputation. He had a reputation as a dogged, very, very loyal and good corporate attorney and someone who was fiercely loyal to George W. Bush. So if there was controversy here about his appointment to the Texas Supreme Court, it stemmed from the fact that he seemed like a Bush insider without a great, you know, wide swath of legal experience being appointed to the highest court in Texas.
My guest is Bill Minutaglio, author of the new book, The President's Counselor, The Rise to Power of Alberto Gonzalez. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Minutaglio. His new book is called The President's Counselor, The Rise to Power of Alberto Gonzalez. After George W. Bush was elected president, he made Alberto Gonzalez his White House counsel. Did you learn any of the behind-the-scenes reasons that went into that appointment?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, among the many reasons that George W. Bush wanted Alberto Gonzalez to come to Washington with him as his White House counsel. Ironically, he was heartily recommended by Harriet Myers, who had been a mentor to Gonzalez in Texas. She had once been George W. Bush's personal attorney here in Texas, and then when an opening emerged for a governor's counsel in Texas, she recommended Alberto Gonzalez. When Bush was going to Washington and casting about and asking people who he should bring with him to Washington, Harriet Myers, among many people, said, "Yeah, you should bring Alberto Gonzalez yet again and let him be your counsel in the White House as well." Again, most Bush insiders have told me that there was a unique political dimension. It was a moment for Bush to name the first Latino White House counsel. It was a great way to position Alberto Gonzalez for two or three political steps down the road and have him begin to raise his profile nationally and position himself for elected office nationally, maybe even back here in Texas at the gubernatorial or Senate level. But yet as well, maybe to position Alberto Gonzalez for a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court.
You make it seem in your book like perhaps a couple of reasons why he remained so close to President Bush and why President Bush made him White House counsel was because he was already very protective of the president, and also he didn't compete for the limelight.
One thing that's, again, critics and adherents of Alberto Gonzalez all agree upon is that he grew up authentically as the son of poorly educated and economically poor migrant workers. His father was an alcoholic who had only had a second-grade education. His mother had only gone to school through the sixth grade. And Alberto Gonzalez grew up in a bubbling, you know, wild environment in a city, Houston, Texas, where people were making money left and right in the 1980s and the real go-go years in Texas and just wild over the top, almost cowboy Caligulas in Texas, just like something out of the old television show Dallas or Dynasty, if you will. And he grew up in this environment really, really poor. He grew up in a home with no hot running water. There was no telephone in his home right up through his high school years. He used to have to go down to the corner to make telephone calls. And, you know, at some point in his life in the 1980s and then into the 1990s, he was The edge of the gilded tent was cracked open for him, and he was allowed into the Bush network it was just a startling and life-changing experience for him, and I think he felt forever grateful and some critics would say slavishly loyal to George W. Bush.
What would you say is the most important part Alberto Gonzalez has played in defining executive powers for the president after September 11th?
As an outgrowth of his loyalty to George W. Bush, and then as an outgrowth of what he and some of the folks who were advising him as co-counsels in the White House believed, they were hell-bent, in a sense, in expanding presidential authority and presidential power. They would argue not to the dereliction of faith, legal faith to the Constitution and our laws, but to really be, quote, forward-leaning, to really try to find the nuances, again, critics would say the loopholes, in laws, in statutes that would give the president the muscle, the might, the power to fight terrorism on any level, whether it be prosecuting the war on terror with the secret military tribunals, studying the exact tenets of the Geneva Conventions to see if they were applicable or not to enemy combatants, folks that we would be detaining in the war on terror, to domestic spying, looking at bank records, phone calls, everything else. There was a lot of discussion at all levels of the executive branch about what exactly it meant in terms of the beginning and end of presidential powers, where what was too expansive, what was just appropriate, what was right.
President Bush was considering the possibility of nominating Gonzalez to the Supreme Court. That would have been very controversial among conservatives because of one of Gonzalez's opinions when he was in the Texas State Supreme Court. Would you talk a little bit about his opinion in that decision?
In Texas, when Alberto Gonzalez was on the Texas Supreme Court, the Supreme Court had to weigh in on an abortion-related decision. And in a nutshell, if you review the case and the specifics, and it was an enormously complex case, and it was loosely related to the fact that down here in Texas, something called the Parental Notification Act had been passed. Broadly speaking, it required minors to tell their parents and their health care providers to tell the parents of the minors that a minor was seeking an abortion. If you really read the way that Gonzalez weighed in on the case, it could be interpreted that he was upholding abortion rights. And whether that's true or not, and it's a matter of some debate because he put in some qualifying language in his opinion that seemed to cater to both sides of the issue, the net political effect of the whole matter is that by the time he wound up in Washington and wound up on the short list for the Supreme Court of the United States, leading conservative activists and commentators, including Robert Novak, seized upon that decision and some of the language in Gonzalez's opinion back in Texas to underscore their belief that he might be supporting abortion as opposed to being an arch enemy of abortion. And it became really probably the death knell for Alberto Gonzalez, I think, in terms of his ascension to the Supreme Court.
President Bush has talked about how much faith is a part of his life. A lot of the people who are close to him share his faith or share deep feelings about faith. What about Alberto Gonzalez? What did you learn about his religious life and how close it is or isn't to the president's?
Alberto Gonzalez grew up ardently Catholic in an ardently, you know, Catholic community. He was a Catholic church-going, you know, youth. He was one of eight children in his family. They were very, very close to the Catholic Church. They knew the parish priest and just grew up in an extensive religious environment and a migrant worker Catholic religious environment. What I found, you know, incredibly interesting again, in terms of a sociocultural evolution, the more that he got to know George W. Bush and the more that he went deeper into that kind of gilded tent again that George W. Bush opened up for him, the more his denominational tendencies changed. And, at present, he worships at what some people call kind of a power conservative church. in Virginia that's populated by a kind of a Protestant Episcopalian congregation, and that is also populated in the pews by a lot of powerful conservatives, former head of the CIA and conservative commentators and conservative speech writers and so forth. So his practical application of faith has actually become more like George W. Bush's, in a sense, denominationally speaking. He's moved away from the Catholic religion and become more of an Episcopal attendee.
Were you able to get an interview with Alberto Gonzalez for your book about him?
No, I tried repeatedly. I'd say probably for 5 months running, posing that question and literally dozens, if not hundreds, of questions to his aides. Received answers to a few questions, ones that I actually, frankly, already knew the answers to.
What's the question you most wish he'd answered of yours?
I'd like to know whether or not he truly believes in all of George W. Bush's policies and philosophies, and whether the way that he ascended to power can be easily replicated by other people in the United States, and especially people who grew up in similar circumstances.
And you want to know if he's an independent thinker or if he's basically a good soldier.
That's the question for the ages. I'd love to sit down with him here in Texas and explore that, in an open, honest way, whether he's just a rubber stamp advisor or whether he feels that he's providing authentic, independent legal advice. And again, not just simply in pursuit of the answers that the president, wants, a predetermined answer, but whether he's giving him, really the full breadth of history and legal knowledge so that the president can make an informed decision.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry. It was great to talk to you.
Bill Minutaglio is the author of the new book, The President's Counselor, The Rise to Power of Alberto Gonzalez. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the sometimes outrageous rhetoric of TV political pundits. This is Fresh Air. The recent flap over Ann Coulter's remarks about the 9/11 widows has many people worrying whether the national political conversation has gotten coarser and meaner than ever before. Not by historical standards, says our linguist Jeff Nunberg. What's new is that politics has become just another kind of reality TV.
Is American public discourse more virulent and partisan than ever before? It might seem so. But in fact, the political rhetoric of earlier days was laced with a venom and outright mendacity that could go elbow to elbow with anything you're liable to see in the modern media. It's the setting that's gotten a whole lot weirder. Americans have always enjoyed the spectacle of political brouhahas. But before the advent of talk radio and Fox News, nobody realized that you could build an entire business model by turning political vilification into a form of popular entertainment. Take Ann Coulter's recent description of the 9/11 widows as witches who were enjoying their husbands' deaths. As defamation goes, that's no more over the top than the things people were saying in the 1864 election, when the Democrats were calling Lincoln a leering buffoon and Horace Greeley was accusing the Democrats of stealing the votes of dead Union soldiers. But it's only in the current age that remarks like those could turn someone into a media celebrity who is invited to appear on Jay Leno and the Today Show to repeat her choicest charges for the delectation of the public. In a way, it's just another sign of the modern triumph of tone over substance. You wouldn't call Coulter a political thinker, no more than you'd call Simon Cowell an arts critic. But like Cowell, Coulter has an unerring sense of television as performance art. It isn't just a gift for making outrageous remarks. Plenty of people do that without being invited onto the Today Show. And in fact, Coulter doesn't get a lot of national attention for her run-of-the-mill ruminations about giving rat poison to Justice Stevens or fragging John Murtha. What made the remark about the 9/11 widows irresistible was its flamboyantly gratuitous tastelessness and the obvious pleasure Coulter took in the effect it had. People have different takes on what Coulter does, of course, beginning with deciding on what to call it. Her defenders like to describe her as a satirist or an ironist, with the implication that her liberal critics don't get the joke. But satire and irony seem pretty far from the mark here. The point of satire is to depict things as grotesque in order to make them seem ridiculous, the way Stephen Colbert does in his Bill O'Reilly persona, or Christopher Buckley does with the pointed caricatures of Thank You for Smoking. But Coulter isn't actually sending anybody up, not herself, certainly, and not the targets of her remarks. Coulter's fans may take pleasure in hearing her talk about poisoning Justice Stevens or saying that it's a pity Timothy McVeigh didn't park his truck next to the New York Times building. But that's not because those remarks made either Stevens or the New York Times seem particularly ridiculous. It's because Coulter seems to be able to get away with unbridled aggression by disguising it as mere mischief-making. If you had to come up with a name for this rhetorical maneuver, the closest you could come would be smut. In the strict sense, of course, smut is the sort of leering innuendo that veils sexual aggression. But in a broader sense, you could think of smut as any kind of nastiness that pretends to be mere naughtiness. It might be a sexual vulgarity, a racial epithet, or simply a venomous insult. What makes it smut is that it's tricked out as humor, so that if anybody claims to be offended, you can answer indignantly, "Touchy, can't you take a joke?" In that broad sense, smut can be innocuous on occasion. In fact, it's a staple of sitcoms in what you could think of as the woo moment. That's the moment when a character who's comically malicious or outspoken makes a remark that's just offensive or risque enough to test the limits of taste, and the studio audience reacts by saying, "Woo." The political talk shows traffic in these moments, too. That shouldn't be surprising, since most of these shows owe a lot to the classic sitcom. In fact, when you think of the most successful practitioners of the genre, like Coulter, O'Reilly, or James Carville, there isn't a one of them who couldn't be the model for a recurring character on Cheers or Drew Carey, the waspish termagant, the bombastic blowhard, the sly yokel. And as on the sitcoms, the drama here is character-driven rather than plot-driven. Watching O'Reilly or Hannity and Combs, you can't help recalling the bickering on All in the Family, where politics was always just a pretext for the clash of personalities. Whatever the issue the shows are talking about, the massacre at Haditha or an increase in wild bachelorette parties, it's going to be grist for the eternal Archie versus Meathead squabble between left and right. "Who are these parents who allow their kids to sleep with Michael Jackson?" Alan Combs asked a couple of years back, and Sean Hannity answered, "Liberals." It's the formulaic comic framework of these shows that makes political smut possible. However offensive a remark might sound in the abstract, it's all in the spirit of entertainment. And as Coulter and other masters of the genre understand, the effect is to aggravate the insult, not alleviate it. You not only get to offer an offense, but to charge people with prim humorlessness when they take umbrage. That's the great rhetorical achievement of our age. Other ages may have been better at mere abuse, but no one can touch us when it comes to driving people up a wall.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. His new book about politics and language is called Talking Right. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From BMW, where every car and SAV they make is built from the ground up to be one thing, a BMW. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. And from Capella University, an accredited university online with degrees in business, IT, education, human services, and psychology. Capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now that Superman has returned, on the next Fresh Air, Jack Larson talks about playing Jimmy Olsen in the original Superman TV series. He has a cameo in the new movie. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.